Hello, I'm Douglas Frank, and I'm here with Laura Marshall for our Spotlight on Members conversation. So Laura, thank you for joining me for this conversation.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I've been looking forward to this this conversation. Great. Because I've known your work, your artwork, for quite a while. And I just have been reading your dissertation, which has been so fun for me.
Oh, great.
So this is very exciting for me to
well, it's very exciting. Someone read the dissertation. I mean, it's who reads dissertations?
Evidently I do.
Well, bless you.
So what originally brought you into the Buddha Dharma?
Interesting question. I moved to Boulder in 1975, and it was definitely the big game in town. And I met people who were involved with the Sangha here. And I remember when I was about maybe 17 or 18, I read Siddhartha, and there's a lot of resonance. You know, I tried meditating in it, and I meditated and stuff. And, but then really ran into it here in town. This is 1975, and the Buddhist community, Trungpa Rinpoche's community, was making quite an impact. And so there was that. And I was actually involved with Sufis at that time, but then through one thing and another, in 1978, I went to British Columbia and planted trees with a Buddhist tree planting cooperative called Vajra Silviculture. And so I certainly met a lot of Buddhists then. And at that time, I remember we all went off and saw some Buddhist teachers that there was a lot of resonance with them. Like there was one in particular whose name I can't remember. It's Dzongtsar's grandfather, Dzongtsar Rinpoche's father, grandfather.
Okay. Okay, and, so in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition.
Right. And there was just something like, oh my goodness, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying or what they were talking about. But I went, look, that was interesting. But then within the year following this adventure, you know, to British Columbia, some things happened that kind of really pushed me in the direction of the Dharma. And I would say top of the list was existence is marked by suffering. And I would say, yeah, it is. that rang true. And then I embarked upon an academic program, and I got to choose my own teachers. And at that time I was very interested in painting mandalas.
And where was this now?
And this is here in Boulder.
Oh, okay.
I came back to Boulder. And Jose Arguelles lived here.
Oh yeah, part yes. Of
the and he was Mr. Mandala. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have called himself that, but he and his wife, Miriam, had written a book about the mandala. So I approached him and I said, can I study with you? And he said, you can study with me, but you have to meditate. So I said, well, okay. And so I started to attend Shambhala, the very early Shambhala trainings. And it was through that I actually learned to meditate. And it was through the meditation that I really connected with the Dharma. It was the practice, very, very powerful. And
okay.
It hit the spot.
Okay. So in some ways, art is what brought you into the Dharma, it sounds like.
That's a good way of putting it. That's true. It was that.
Yeah.
It was that, and it's been that all along.
What aspect of art was sort of the finger pointing the way, so to speak, or that intrigued you?
Well, that's interesting. It's back to this thing with the mandala. And before I came to Boulder, I was living in Nova Scotia. And this is before the Sangha had moved there. This is before anybody knew about it. I was living on a farm in Cape Breton Island, and it was winter. And I just began, I had this little book of patterns, and I started to paint them. They were circular patterns. I didn't know very much about the mandala. And I started to paint them, and I had this experience of very, very powerful, spontaneous images in my mind, much stronger than what I was making out, you know, on paper or wherever. And I just really noticed that. I was very intrigued by it, that I was following this particular form and that something really got awakened in my mind. And you know, later when I learned more about Tibetan Buddhism and about visualization, I said that it was as if that muscle had been sort of awakened. And that was my curiosity. That was what I wanted to study with Jose about. In fact, we didn't do that. We didn't really paint very many mandalas. He became an important teacher for the history of art. And he taught a methodology for a global perspective of the history of art, which I was able to develop and teach at Naropa over 10 years, starting in the 90s. And I don't know how I would say that was about the Dharma, except it's something about sort of the inherent wisdom of all peoples, that I, you know, all people, all cultures, you know, the inclination to wisdom and the possibility to wake up. And so that was what I was looking at in this global perspective on art history. And at the same time, I was doing music programming on KGNU, the community radio station here. And I did that for 23 years. And just the beauty and wisdom that was that human beings are capable of, and wanting to learn more about that. And when I taught the history of art, it was like, my God, you know, this is not the history of art. This is a display of wisdom. So
in reading your dissertation, you have a, it seems to me you have a strong connection to very Jungian sort of ground to a lot of this mandala and creative impulses and that. Mm-hmm. So at what point did you sort of finally decide to quote unquote become a Buddhist? Maybe you haven't.
I have. The Jungian, you read the dissertation. The dissertation is from the Pacifica Graduate Institute. And if you go there, you can't swing a cat without hitting a picture of Jung. I mean, so you have to mention Jung. I mean, you have to bring the minor is in depth psychology. But anyway, I took refuge in, I think, about 1981 or two, and then took my bodhisattva vows in about 84. So I embark upon the path. Mm-hmm. Right at that time. I knew that this was what I wanted to do.
So do you have a favorite Dharma teaching or slogan that acts as your North Star?
Well, of course that changes. I mean, a real North Star would not change, would it? But but in fact, there's one that is very meaningful to me right now. And I spent the month of January this year at the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And there are these four vows that is said in the Zen tradition, but there's this wonderful translation of them. And they are my North Star at this time. So that the way they go is, creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Mm-hmm. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Mm-hmm. So I like, that's to me very inspiring. So not that.
How long have you, the North Star does change over time. So how long have you been working with these four principles that have become important to you?
Well, like I say, I sort of really came upon them over the last couple of years at the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. But I think because I did their winter practice period, and we said it so often. This has been this year, but I think on a larger that's an interesting question, because in a larger sense, why it would resonate now is this I think that in the Buddhist teachings, it's like this world is a display of luminosity and wisdom. And we don't always see it that way. So I think it's this effort to find to work with my own mind so that I am able to perceive and to experience and to act upon the inherent wisdom in reality. So I would say that. So that's it. So the ones I just quoted sort of seem pretty good. Like, reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. Or delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to transform them. That's a good one.
That's a very good one.
Yeah.
Very good one. Yeah, that's a good bumper sticker. Right? It'd be nice to have that on one's back of one's car on the bumper. Yeah. So people behind can look at that.
I'm sorry, could you say that again, please?
How did you connect with Nalanda Bodhi and the Punlap Rinpoche?
Oh, let's see. I had been aware of him when he came to visited Naropa. I don't even remember the first time. But it's it was at various points in the 90s. And I remember doing one workshop with him, and he shone a particular light on the Dharma, which I had not heard, which is that it is love. It is love. This is about loving the world and loving each other, and about bringing out the love and wisdom that is innate within us. So whenever he came to town, I'd, you know, take workshops and stuff. And then I lived in the Hudson River Valley, and he visited there. So again, that was wonderful. Got to see him there. And then I went to Nitarta Institute when it was held in New Brunswick in, I think, 2004. And I especially that Nitarta Institute was very, very rich. It was very, very rich and very illuminating. And, I'm still working with the things there that I learned there. Yeah.
Okay. What is there any one particular thing that you're sort of focused on at this particular point?
You mean
from Nitarta? Yeah.
I remember. Well, there was this one day, and a whole bunch of us were sitting. And it was, you know, it was New Brunswick and everything's green and the light and there are trees and the wind going through the trees. And we were sitting under this big tree. And there was this one teacher, and I will not try to say his name because I will get it wrong. But he was trying to explain to us the difference between seeing something real and seeing something as a concept. And he would say, he'd say, this is real. And then he'd hide it and say, this is a concept. And we just could not. And then he'd do it again. And like, you know, this is real and this is a con, you know. And none of us could quite get it. And then we came up with the idea that, you know, we imagine that tree. And the tree is you know, waving in the wind and the light, and it's shining, and you look at it and you go, wow, that tree, and it's there. But then the next day you're in a hurry and you run out of the house and you just go, tree. You don't really look at it, and you kind of rush off and you just go tree or car or person or whatever. And meanwhile, the tree is continuing, and so the idea of really being in relationship with this world and engaging one's senses with the display and the energies of this world, rather than being an idea or a concept, that is reality, and I just love that. And, again, that comes back to art and particularly the practice of drawing what you see. And that's something I've done. I was very lucky. I studied in Italy. And so it's very much about drawing what, engaging with reality. And so that.
That's sweet. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Is there anything that has captured you, any passion that or things that are interesting to you during this period of time of living with COVID?
there are several things that have been sort of ongoing. Like I work very deeply with the I Ching, the Chinese Book of Changes, and I continue to work with that. And so there's always that, and it's always very inspiring and very so there's that. And I read a book early on this year, and in the pandemic, I with a friend, I read a book by Sharon Salzberg called Faith. And I read it several times. That really was very inspiring because I think I grew up and as a Christian, and not a fundamentalist or anything. It was just that was religion, and my ancestors were Huguenots and fled, from the old world to the new world to be able to practice religion and so forth. And so it's in my cells, my parents and grandparents and great grandparents, that's all. And it's a kind of a complicated thing to change your faith. And so, well, what is faith now? I mean, if God isn't gonna, take care of me, reach down and do it for me, how does this work? And so her book was very good. And another thing that has been, it's ongoing, and it's not quite on board yet, is that I've taken up the cello at this late date in my life. And it sounds perfectly god-awful at this point, but I'm working with it. And it's just such a beautiful instrument. And I can't go anywhere. And I play the cello. And
so are you taking lessons online?
Some of them are I've been meeting outside with a cello teacher.
Okay.
It's, I think, especially with the cello, that it's important to be in person. And so we're working it out. Right. We figured it out.
So how much are you playing the cello?
Every day, an hour and a half or more. And until my neighbor comes back from his walk. he's very patient. I do appreciate it, but it's a fascinating instrument.
It is.
It's very beautiful, and it's all about resonance and hearing and
feeling it in your body.
Yeah, it's very very much about that. So it's and it holds a potential of playing with other people.
Exactly.
Making music with other people and so that's I think what I'm really hoping for.
Oh, that sounds like a great thing. Oh yeah.
They say anywhere from a year to 2 years is how long it takes for it to start sounding halfway decent, but got to start somewhere.
Exactly. and start now, and so a year and a half from now kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
Time to emerge from the COVID thing, I'll be ready to join an orchestra.
Well, this is a great passion to act upon. So I'm assuming you've had this thought about the cello for a while.
Oh yeah, a long time. Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's really nice. Could we just go back to the a little bit of about faith for one
moment.
And because it's a major term that is used in the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah.
Faith. And what are you getting out of, or what have you gotten out of Sharon's book?
You know, it's still cooking. I'm not arrived yet. But one thing about Sharon is that she starts that book by describing some events in her early life, which was extremely difficult. And when I heard her say that, I went, okay, I'm going to listen to what she says, because she experienced complete collapse and devastating losses. And she understood something about faith. And so that book is a journey about her faith and her journey of faith. And I am not sure that I have come around yet to what mine is. But one thing I would say is that I remember when I was doing Shambhala training and I did level 2. And, we're sitting there and it's getting, and I remember going in for my interview, and that was the one where basic goodness was introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some sort of something in our conversation where I suddenly understood that this whole process in which we are involved is good.
Mm-hmm.
It is good.
Mm.
It is luminous. It is awake and awakening. Mm. And I had no idea of that at all. And I remember saying, you mean this is a good trip, you know? Good?
Mm.
And it was like this, if you imagine looking out on a big plain and dark, 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 dark clouds, and just this little crack of light on the horizon that is just breaking through. It's like, oh, and not in a Pollyanna-ish way, but this is an extraordinary process and what part of it.
Mm.
And I'm still navigating that journey between my pessimism or despair or whatever it was, and understanding this is a really amazing process to be a part of.
Mm.
And don't you want to know more about it and join in and, you know, and so I would say that that's something about it. My habitual tendency to be pessimistic is pretty strong.
Oh, I can appreciate that.
It's not like, oh, it'll turn out, you know.
Right.
I really don't know if it will. I don't think that's what it's about, but it's something about being able to perceive this as an unfolding process in which wisdom and luminosity are inherent part of it.
Mm.
You know, so and that's still quite the mystery for me. It's still quite the mystery for me. Mm. So I'm still working with it, and I we're given a great deal to work with it, you know, like, so sitting practice is I don't know what we did to deserve what we've been given or how generously we have been given this.
Mm.
So anyway.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
I love the light on the horizon. Yeah,
just through the clouds. Yeah,
I think, you know, I mean, Trungpa Rinpoche, he would always talk about the great eastern sun always rising and has that sort of quality of, there's light there and it's coming up.
Yeah.
Is there, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
Is there anything else you would like to share before we finish?
Maybe that's what I was going to say. I think there's a story. It's in the Vimalakirti Sutra, I think. And I think that, one of, maybe Shariputra or somebody in the Buddhist circle, there's you know, sitting in this beautiful, you know, park or something. And this, and so my understanding of the story is the Buddha says, so, you know, how are you doing? And how, and the guy just says, oh, just, it sucks. You know, it's like, who knows who's going to win the election and stuff. So the Buddha actually puts his thumb down or his toe or something. And all of a sudden the world appears as jewels. Everything is radiant. Mm-hmm. And that's really intriguing to me. That's really intriguing to me of how we see things. You know, the story, if you went to, you know, Calcutta or something or Manhattan with the Buddha won't go, wow, this is it. This is a display of Buddha nature. And I'm going, oh, no, no, it's just a no. But in fact, it is. And so that is that edge, that pivot is really interesting to me of how we perceive reality. And just to sort of clear away the congestion and the veils, the obstructing veils, in order to see and experience and be part of the luminosity that I think is there. So,
Well, that's
that we are told is there.
Thus, I have heard.
Yes, I have heard and seen.
And seen. Oh, exactly. Yeah, glimpses. And for me, it's those glimpses that sort of moves the needle from sort of this blind faith to more, as we say, more confidence in that. Well, thank you so much. There are so many other threads we could pick up.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being a part of this conversation with me.
Yeah. Thank you for doing it. Good idea.
Oh, you're very welcome. Great. I'm going to.